Stop. Stand still. And listen. Really listen. Beyond the busy road. Through the conversations happening on the street. Hear how the soft wind catches the leaves of an ash tree. Notice how a starling calls out to its young. Tune in to the rustle of a bird's wings. Concentrate on the sounds of your world. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. In this series, we hear from those who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. Our guest today on What's Your Map has spent her career thinking about and listening to the natural world in all its forms, from the beautiful and disturbing to the intimate and uncanny. Michaela Wiese is an award-winning writer based in Berlin, whose books have covered as diverse a range of topics as industrialization, the weather, love, and the jobs lost to history. Her book, Tea with the Buddha, recounted her years spent living in a Japanese monastery and was a bestseller in Germany. As well as writing, Michaela is an acclaimed documentary maker, radio producer, lecturer, and curator, and was once described by one critic as specialising in the unfamiliar. Michaela's latest project, co-authored with the writer Isaac Yuen, is The Sound Atlas, a book documenting sounds and, in some cases, silences from across the universe. Michaela, thank you so much for joining us today on What's Your Map? And I'd just like to start by asking you, what is the map that we're going to be looking at today?
So we're going to be looking at a map on which many sounds are cartographed. So the map will turn us into cartographers of sound, I would say.
How do we map sound? How do you map sounds, Michaela? I mean, what we're looking at here is this amazing world map. And just take me through some of the images. It's just a standard world map. And you've got all these different points on it where you've been mapping sound. How many points are there?
So altogether, I think it's 94 sounds. And it's very often it's sounds of landscapes. You know, you have sounds of icebergs, but you also have very arid landscapes. You have jungles and silences as well. You've got in-between spaces. There are many sounds from the natural worlds. The eternal fight between bats and moths, cicadas, echoes, technical sounds. It's a lot in there.
And just tell me about the map as we look at it. So you've projected it onto, what's the world map that we've got here? Is this a Google map?
Yeah, it's just a simple Google map. And, you know, you can just drop a pin there and then download the sound, attach it with it. So you can zoom over the map and each place has a sound and a description what sound it is and where it is. So you could be visiting it. But so you've got this map, but what you're not seeing is also because sound is also a temporal thing. So it's an atlas, yeah. So it's a geographical map, but it's also a map in time because some of the sounds on it are no longer there.
Some of the sounds in the atlas are human made, and some are natural. Could you give me a sense of an overview of the way in which you chose different kind of sounds? What kind of things are we looking at, Michaela?
We try to go into different landscapes, you know, because landscapes are always, I feel you can, if you really listen to a landscape, you can listen to deep time into it, you know, because the kinds of insects that are there because of the kinds of plants, and the kind of plants are there because of the sand, because of the stones and the minerals in them. And that's there because of geology, and that's there because of deep time, how it's moved. So anytime you're in a space, I think, yeah, you can hear a lot about the history. Even though you're just listening for a moment, you can listen to this wide spectrum that tells you much more. So we're trying to cover different landscapes and also the water, because water is such a better carrier for sound, you know. And there is this story that if a blue whale would sing near Ireland into the Sofa Channel, which is this place in the water which is compressed through temperature and salinity, and it really is like a tunnel in the sea. And if the blue whale with its frequency would sound into there, 20 minutes later a whale in the Bermudas could hear it and respond. So within 40 minutes there could be a question and answer. And we're only finding out about this these days.
It is an astonishing fact. I think that was amazing when I read about this. This is incredible.
Yes. And we also try to write about sounds like the atomic bomb, you know, how the sound that comes with the explosion of the atomic bomb is told to us very differently to what it really is. You would imagine that it's this really deep rumbling sounds, and any movie where there is an atomic bomb explosion, it would be, there's actually a guidebook on how to mix it as a sound technician. You have a waterfall and then an explosion. It's more like a gunshot. It's a very quick sound.
One of my favorites, if we can talk about some of them, because I do encourage people to listen through the map, because they're beautiful, they're haunting, they're sometimes very shocking, very disturbing. I did love the Altai Meadow, which I listened to. Tell me about that and the geography there and what we're looking at. It's very, very powerful.
Well, that's one of my favorite stories, is the Altai Mountains, because it's a place where I had a special calling to. It was maybe 8 years ago that I saw an advertisement on one of the banners on my internet, and on it was a mountain, and I immediately fell in love with this mountain.
Where was it?
Well, I didn't, you know, I usually don't look at this advertisement. I was like, but where is this mountain? And yeah, it said Altai, and I was like, that sounds very nice. Where is it? And I looked on the map, and Altai is really in the middle of the Eurasian continent. Like, really, if you drew a line from the Atlantic Ocean to the Chinese Sea, and then from the polar regions down to the Indian Ocean, right in the middle is this place, Altai. So it's now bordering Russia, Kazakhstan, Mongolia, and China. I had such a strong calling for this place that I really wanted to go. And but I have three children, and it's not always easy to go. And my father in those days, he was in the last stages of cancer, and I visited him and I said, listen, there's this place, Altai. I'd really like to go. And he said, like, then you must go. You must go. And so I got a research grant to go based on this story that in the 10th century, Vladimir the Great, he had heard that there's a place far east where people live in harmony. And he had sent out lots of monks, and one monk in a dream had said, yes, you must go east, further, further east, and you will come to this place. So I was trying to find this place. And I took the Trans-Siberian tramway all the way from Berlin to the Altai Mountains. It takes 5 days. I only had to change it once in Moscow, all the way there. Then I found someone who drove me in a car further down. And we did come to a valley where there was every day a rainbow, and where there were meadows of, it was summer, so the Siberian summers are beautiful, you know, the golden sunlight. And there's these meadows with all these insects, and every insect has its own frequency and sound. And you walk into these fields with your arms stretched out. It sounds terribly tacky, but, you know, it's a really healing sound. Yeah. There's something to it. And it's almost like you imagine that here in the West, every meadow must have sounded like that a long time ago, before the Industrial Revolution. And there just never has been an industry in the Altai.
I love the way you write about it at the end of the chapter on the Altai. You say, while some still search for the land of peace and harmony in the worlds and stars above, one of the last paradises on earth lies vulnerable at our mercy. And that's the area that is, of course, under threat. So there's a way in which there's a poetry how you describe these places, but it is also very much about the vulnerability of landscapes and the sounds that they convey that we are losing.
Well, we are living in a time of crisis, I think. You know, these landscapes, many of these landscapes will not be there anymore. They're already not sounding like they used to. Everything,
Can we hear what you heard?
Mm-hmm. And so I will play you the meadows of the Altai Mountains.
The sound is kind of, it's hypnotic. It makes me sort of almost want to hear more of it. So now I want to say, let's hear more, let's hear more. So if there were other examples of your favorite sounds, where else would we go? Where would you take us on the Atlas?
Well, I really liked the Olympic National Forest, the Ho Forest in the US. It's on the west coast of the Pacific.
Is this the sound of the moss? Is this where we hear that?
Yes.
Yeah. So tell me about that. I think this is wonderful. So you almost have a natural, what we'd call, I guess, in radio terms, a damper, which is the moss sort of creates this sort of dead sound almost.
Yes. It's a northern rainforest. So you have lots of moss and lichen and ferns. And it really swallows all sounds. It rains a lot there. There's a lot of fog. But even the rain has a very different sound when it drops. You know, Gordon Hampton, he's a sound ecologist. He called it one of the most silent places on the planet. It's not silent, but it's got an imminent sound, you know. It's a silence that stems from within.
I love the stories also of ambient music where you talk about composers who've responded to that. Tell me about that. I thought this was such a wonderful story.
In Tokyo, they've got 44 of the busiest train stations in the world, yet it's always really peaceful. And maybe one of the reasons is because they had a composer, Mukaiya, compose little jingles for each train station. And he just tried to, they're just 7 seconds long, and he tried to weave something of the fabric of the history of this place into the jingles. In Ningyo-jo, which would be where all the nice Japanese sweets are, he would reflect the sounds of the sweets. and so there would be a place where older people live, and he would play older songs into it. So when you ride the train, you can close your eyes and just from the sound and the music, feel where you are.
Before we move even deeper into Michaela Wiese's world of sound, I'd love for all listeners to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From exploring cave etchings to charting constellations, we have a wealth of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest, or story from this series, or the next. Now, I want to hear more about Michaela's auditory adventures. How did you choose them? What was the criteria for selecting certain sounds? And also, I'm interested in the range, because we look at this map and there's quite a lovely range here. So there's a lot in North America, some in South America, only one I see, I think, in Africa, quite a few constellated in Europe and some in Southeast Asia. So what was your criteria for how you selected them?
It's always about how do you construct a narrative around it? How can you talk about sound? You know, it's a little bit like maybe reading a book on food and not necessarily eating it, but next time you taste something, you know what to think about when you taste it. You know, it becomes more complex through the reading. And the same, I think, we're trying to do with the sounds by describing the sounds, making people more aware what to listen for everywhere around them. And so, you know, it could be historical facts, but then sound is such an ephemeral thing. It's a release of energy, and something releases that sound. So you can talk about that. You can talk about how the sound hits you. You know, our body is made up of so many hollow spaces that can tremble and reverberate, and the sound really enters our body. You know, like different to the visual impact, you can always close your eyes and stay away, but sound really is an embodiment. And I think that's quite interesting.
And it's one that we've, perhaps I got the sense from the book, but your argument is that we've sort of lost a certain kind of relationship to sound, perhaps. In a way, the visual is so important for us, and I guess also hearing. But that sense of the sound, the impact of sound, because you're also interested, and you always have been, I think, in your work, in what's not considered a sound in some ways, which is silence. But of course, it's like a binary opposition, isn't it? You can't have silence without sound. So is there a sense in which you're trying to reclaim the importance of sound? I think there is. From the end of the book, there's this importance about saying that we need to think about the sounds and across the cosmos as well.
Mm. I think what the Sound Atlas is trying to do is make us more into listeners. So this one thing is, of course, sound, but the other thing is you have to be open to listening. You have to be, you know, you have to quiet yourself down. You have to be present. I think to be a true listener, you have to be very present in the moment. And I think that is what we're trying to do. And yeah, we do live in an overstimulation of sights. You know, I used to be friends with Tommy Gowen, interface designer from New York, and he did this fantastic picture of how a computer sees us. And it's just a giant eye with a giant finger and a tiny ear.
And tell me about the inspiration for the Sound Atlas. Where did that come from?
So Isaac Ewan and I, we used to be in a residency in Switzerland, and we used to do long walks. It was in the Jura Mountains, and there was a little stream there, this little water. And I always like to listen to water, like running water. And that stream in particular was really, it just had a really nice, lively sound. And at that time, both of us were reading Ursula K. Le Guin, The Dispossessed. And maybe I'll just read that one quote.
Yeah. Great, great fantasy and sci-fi writer, wonderful writer, Ursula Le Guin. Yeah.
So it goes, "Life," said the stream of quick water down on the rocks in the cold dark. There's something about this quote, about sound being so alive, you know. And then, so that stayed with us, I think, this feeling of, yeah, what is, you know, what is hidden in sound? What is there? And then we had a very opposite experience in Berlin. There was an exhibition about sound stories, and there was this chamber where they played these very dark sounds, and the sound was really frightening, and it made you actually feel quite sick in your body, you know. And we're saying, so okay, so between these, the one is the lively sound that revigorates you, you know. There's even in Japan, in Shinto, there is this idea also that sound can revigorate your soul. You know, in life you get tired, but sound can really bring back something in you. On the other hand, there's these sounds that are just deep and scary, and you know, these kind of sounds were used in, you know, we know that old armies would carry these huge trumpets and drums, and just to scare the enemy away. So there's something in this, yeah, in this space that was very interesting. And then my background is in Japanese studies, so in Japan, to hear, to listen, kiku is written with a gate, and there is an ear sitting in the gate.
Right.
So, and this gate by itself is usually called ma, which is a space in between spaces. And I always feel there's something about sound. It it opens up a crack in the everyday. You know, it's almost like sound as a portal to something deeper that we can understand on a very different level than the world, the visual world. Yeah, I love that very much.
And can you tell me about your collaborator on the Sound Atlas, Isaac Ewan?
So Isaac Ewan is a very prolific writer from Vancouver, but he now lives in Berlin as well. He's got a degree in biology and loves animals. So everything you found in the Sound Atlas about animals, about cicadas, about fish orgies.
that's Isaac.
Yeah, that's Isaac, because he just is great with wordplay and earth play, and he just knows everything about animals, and that's fantastic.
Probably your most well-known book is Tea with the Buddha, which recounts your time spent in Japan. I wonder if you could talk a bit about that and how it influenced this work. Was that really where the fascination with sound, and particularly sound and silence, came from?
So really, one of my first experiences in Japan was after studying the language for 3 years, that I spent a year in a Buddhist monastery in the south of Japan, and I had a Zen monk who would teach me meditation. It was one of the oldest Zen monasteries in Japan, and it was just the old monk and I would sit there in stillness, and there was an open window outside, and when you sit there and meditate, you know, maybe there's a wind coming in, there's a cicada singing outside. That becomes your companions, right, for it. I think there's something about, just from the aesthetics of the country, there is something where, you know, here in the West, we're looking maybe for smells and for visuals, but hardly for sound. Sounds is covered by music. But in Japan, sound, the ambient of sound, is really part of the aesthetics. I think that's what it is. So I've been in places like in the mountains of Japan where, you know, I would really think the soundscape here is just wonderful. There will be trickling water, there will be wind chimes, you know, there will be, and there's also such a big effort in Japan to be silent. You know, the doors, they are sliding doors. You can't bang them closed. You slide them open, that's a very nice sound. You will try and walk very quiet on the tatami mats. You will maybe try and enhance the sounds of nature in your garden by maybe putting a little bamboo there that fills with water and just goes like knock, knock, knock. And that just enhances the sounds by giving you some kind of sound orientation from which you can spring to further sounds.
And did that change your early life and your encounter with sound and, I guess, the natural world? Because you're somebody who's known for being interested in writing about nature, although it's very interesting that you live in such an urban environment in Berlin. But I wonder how that experience in Japan changed how you saw earlier parts of your life, or did it make you reflect in different ways on the natural world that you'd grown up in and that you were used to in the West?
No, I think the entire experience of learning to speak Japanese has changed a lot, because just the way you express things in the spoken, I mean, the written is a whole universe by itself, with having the pictograms, with the kanjis, you know, where each word is a symbol and the combination of these symbols becomes something else. But in the spoken language, I always feel, in Berlin, you go to a bar, you meet someone, and you are trying to get as fast as possible to that point where, bang, you collide. There's a kind of it's a fun energy where you just, you know, it's like you're going bam, 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 telling stories and trying to really create these sparks. Whereas in Japan, when you meet someone for the first time, you're each going one step further back. You're really trying to create that space between the two of you. And until you feel, okay, this is how big of a space the two of us can hold. And then you've spent some time, quite some time, to feel into that space. And then it can take years for coming closer again. But so there's, in just in the way you approach communication is very different. And I think it was more that which I think I took for my other work, because I always try to feel, you know, into topics of the world, and I try to feel, what are they really? What is it?
Can you find a space of nature in Berlin too? Is there still a way in which there's a connection to something that's... Because we make those distinctions between the natural and the cultural and the urban and the rural. And it's much more complicated than that, isn't it? I think that's one of the things that your work is very much about. You can't make those absolute distinctions and divisions.
No. And it's, I mean, I always think we as humans, we are part of nature. And I think that's part of the problem, that we always think us separate of nature. We always think there is nature and there is us humans, but we are part of this whole web that nature is. And, you know, I sometimes teach nature writing at university, at the art university in Berlin, and I will go out with the students and look at the, you know, nature is everywhere there. In every crack there is nature, and we will try and find these places that speak to us, and then create made-up names for these places. So, you know, because it's this old story that once you have a name for something, it becomes something. So just because we don't have a name for a little sheet of grass growing out of the sidewalk doesn't mean it doesn't exist, you know. And then on top of it, I mean, an urban area is such an exciting place for nature, and Berlin even more so, you know, because we've got this whole having been in the Cold War and having these places that for 40 years were not visited by anyone because they were in these barren places. They were, you know, the space between the walls where just anything could grow. And that legacy is still there in the city. And that's kind of fun to discover that. So it's just always shifting slightly from the normal and trying to find that is besides that. And I think that's what nature writing is maybe often about. It's, you know, finding a voice for those who are not loud enough for us to listen. So I think that's part of the work I do, is I try to listen to the voices that are more, subdued, but that nevertheless, just because they're not bullying and loud, just have really beautiful stories as well.
And what you hear is very beautiful. The work is wonderful, and The Sound Atlas is a great book. And as a former Berliner, it's been wonderful to talk to you. Michaela Wiese, thank you so much for joining me on What's Your Map?
Lovely being here. Thank you.
From the music of Tokyo train stations to the humming fields of a mountain range in Mongolia, I've covered all kinds of wonderful terrain thanks to Michaela Wiese and my ears. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch at Whistledown Studios. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland collection and send suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com.